Thank you. It's great to be here, and I really do appreciate your inviting me to speak. As a teacher for over 30 years, I always like to have a captive audience, and the issue will probably be my keeping within my time limit. My topic today is the Declaration of Independence, and it has a little bit to do with women's response, but it also has to do with how men and various groups of people have responded to it over the years. So I hope you will indulge my use of the text throughout my talk, because I'm going to be looking at the Declaration itself, and I'm also going to be looking at various speeches that people have given about the Declaration. So hidden under the podium here is a stack of books. Anyway, that will be my talk for today. We just celebrated the 4th of July, and most of us probably enjoyed the fireworks and maybe a barbecue. Some of you may know this story about Colonel Sanders. As a matter of fact, we did pick up some Kentucky Fried Chicken for our kids on the holiday, and it turns out that he got his start, apparently, in making fried chicken for the 4th of July. And there was an interview with him many years ago in The New Yorker where the BBC was asking him how he got started, and he said, well, I always prepared chicken on the 4th of July. You know, the 4th of July, do you celebrate it? And the reporter said, no. And he said, gee, that's too bad. It's a great holiday. So anyway, many of you may have been enjoying your Kentucky Fried Chicken and various other things, but far too few of us really spend time looking at the Declaration and reflecting on what it actually means. And so that's what I'm going to do. First, I want to talk a little bit about Thomas Jefferson and the sources of his thought in preparing it.
Too loud.
I'm too loud. Okay. Maybe if I step back, is that better?
Yeah, just step back a little bit.
Do you think that's okay? Thank you. Please keep me posted if it's, you know.
That's fine.
That's good? Okay, thanks. In any event, I want to start with Thomas Jefferson, or I guess I should say that the way in which many people, myself included, conceive of the Declaration is really as a national charter. It's not a document that gives us legal standing to sue, or it's not a framework of our laws like the Constitution, but it is something that many of us, I think, even unconsciously, think about when we think about what's right and wrong, when we think about what it means to be an American, when we think about what it means about how we treat people. I think it's deeply embedded, if you will, in our soul as a people, and I think that's important to keep in mind. Now, as far as Jefferson was concerned, he was a man of the Enlightenment, and in the writing of the Declaration, he was very much influenced by the works of John Locke, and I would say even by extension of Isaac Newton. The idea that man, and when I use the word man, I include women, but I'm not sure that Jefferson did, that man is a rational being, that by use of man's mind, we can discover the secrets of the universe, that we can conduct our lives in a good and orderly fashion, and that we could understand the world around us because the world around us is organized in terms of natural laws, and that we're capable of understanding these laws really without even going to sources of authority, like to priests, for instance, to ask what does this mean, or even by going to the Bible to figure out what does this mean, but really by our observation, by our powers of observation and our powers of thought. And I think in those ways he really is indebted to the Enlightenment. A lot of the ideas that are in the Declaration of Independence really come from John Locke, who applied a lot of these ideas of the Enlightenment, of universality, of laws, to the social contract that he put into his works in the 1690s, the two treatises on government. And John Locke himself was writing right after the restoration of the British monarchy, the what's known as the Glorious Revolution, where William and Mary took the throne. And what's interesting about that is that the people of Britain invited William and Mary to take the throne rather than their being just passed on in terms of their inheritance to the throne. And so it really was a constitutional monarchy that was chosen by the people of Britain. And so when Locke wrote his treatises on government, he was justifying the fact that this was not divine right of kings, but that this was the people of Great Britain who were choosing their own rulers, and they were doing so under a contract. And when I actually look at the Declaration, I'll talk a little bit more about where Locke stands, because the wording of it is very similar to the wording that Locke gave it. So without further ado, I'm going to take out one of my books here, and I'm going to read to you a little bit about, a little bit of the Declaration itself. So here we go. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them to another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. That's the first paragraph. Now, there's a couple of things in here that I want to call to your attention. The first is the appearance of a notion of natural law. When in the course of human events, the idea that human events follow a course is itself a belief that there's some order to it. It's not just one, as we say, damn thing after another. There's some organization. There's some course that it takes. And a course is predictable. You know where it's going, not only where it came from, but where it's going to. Another phrase here, to which the laws of nature and nature's God. So nature has laws. Nature is not just something arbitrary, but nature has laws. And if it has laws, then people who use their minds are capable of understanding those laws. And, of course, nature's God, because the idea is, in the sense that God is part of nature, that perhaps God is the author of nature. And one of the ideas of the Enlightenment is that, and by the way, the Enlightenment is very complicated and there's many strains to it, and I'm just going very lightly and talking about a couple of key ideas, but there's lots more that I'm not talking about, so just be aware of that. Anyway, one of the ideas of the Enlightenment is that God created this universe and he created it according to laws, and that God has retired pretty much from the universe and it continues to operate according to these laws. And therefore, through science, through rationality, through mathematics, and even through the observation of human societies, we can see these laws in operation. And by seeing those laws, we have some idea of God as well. So all that's just in the first paragraph of the Declaration. Now we get to the part that is the most important part, the part that's quoted all over the world, the part that's remembered. The second paragraph, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I think it's interesting, and I noticed there were a few articles in this last week about this phrase, self-evident, and as many of you may know, the Declaration was written by a committee of five people, except that Thomas Jefferson really did the writing of it, but then he got the consent of the committee and the advice of the committee and made certain changes. And on that committee, one of the people on that committee was Benjamin Franklin. And Thomas Jefferson's original draft was, we hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable. And Franklin said, no, to replace it with self-evident. So, and of course, Franklin himself, like Jefferson, was a man of the Enlightenment. So it's interesting, truths to be self-evident, what does that mean? It means that, to me it means, I'm assuming it means that to others, all you have to do is keep your eyes open and look, and it's obvious, it's evident. It doesn't have to do with proving it or anything. There it is. Okay, so we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. And I thought it was interesting last week when John said, what does it mean to be a man? And that's something that we'll look at, how different definitions are given to it. But anyway, so it's self-evident that all men are created equal. Now, in what way are they equal? Obviously, they're not equal in their talents. They're not equal in their appearance. What do we mean by equal? Well, the definition that follows with Jefferson is that they are equal in that they have certain rights. So I'll just quickly read that. That all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. So that means rights that are just within them, that are among these are life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And life, liberty, and property were the three that John Locke used. Jefferson varies that a little bit with pursuit of happiness, and I'll talk just a bit about happiness in a minute. But the idea is that whatever we look like, whatever our talents are or are not, we are all, as creatures of God, in a sense, given by God or given in our birth these unalienable rights that supposedly cannot be taken away or granted to us because we already have them, and that these are life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Now, just let me say a word about happiness here. This comes from an article that appeared in the New York Times just a few days ago, and I think it's a very nice little summary about some of the pros and cons of happiness. Because it always seems a little odd. I mean, we know what life is. Well, not all of us agree about when it starts, but I think we all know what it is. Liberty, we probably could agree on that, but what is happiness? It's such an amorphous idea, and it varies so from one person to another. So let me just read. This article is from the June 29th issue of the New York Times. It's by John Leyland. And it says, to Jefferson and his contemporaries, the meaning of happiness was clear and relatively circumscribed, actually. And then according to historian Paul Lynn Meyer, who's written extensively on the Declaration of Independence and the founding of the United States, he says, I don't think it meant pleasure in our sense of carnal pleasures or material wealth. Happiness demanded a good government. That seems so crazy to us, but when they spoke of the ideal, they used biblical language, to be at peace under your vine and fig tree, with none to make you afraid. So I guess the idea that there's order and that there's peace and that you have an opportunity to then be happy. For the founders, children of the Enlightenment, the pursuit of happiness replaced older imperatives like religious or filial duty. So I guess you could say that was another part of it, that to pursue our happiness was a duty or gift that we had as opposed to religious imperatives or familial ones. At the same time, this concept of happiness has caused a lot of us to be alienated and extremely unhappy as we think, well, we should be happy. In many societies, happiness isn't even on the radar screen. I mean, you do what you're supposed to do, and that's the end of it. But what we're supposed to do is make ourselves happy. And so there were a couple of interesting quotes here that I thought I'd share with you. Jefferson burdened his descendants with a condition which Darren McMahon, who's a professor at Florida State, called, quote, the unhappiness of not being happy. And then it goes on to say, this condition reflects not the failed pursuit of happiness, but the successes. Alexis de Tocqueville and Ralph Waldo Emerson in the next century, meaning the 19th century, saw that happiness was being pursued apace. if to unintended effect, and then there's a quote from Emerson, which I thought you'd appreciate since, of course, he, like Jefferson, was a Unitarian, our people are surrounded with greater external prosperity and general well-being than the Indians or the Saxons, Emerson wrote, yet we are sad, but they are not. What's wrong with this picture? So anyway, moving on from happiness back to this whole idea of Locke and the idea of the social contract, we see that really what the Declaration of Independence is arguing is that since we have these unalienable rights, we choose governments in order to make these rights secure. The government doesn't give us these rights. They're unalienable. But we have governments who have the job of making these rights secure, and we have the right to choose that government. And here it says it, I think very plainly, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute a new government. And so on. You've all heard this, I'm sure, many, many times. But this was when Locke wrote very similar ideas, and when Jefferson wrote these ideas, this was a new idea, the idea that people could choose their own governments, and that they choose their governments in order to perform a limited function, which is to make their God-given or unalienable rights secure. So Jefferson lays this all out. And what I think is so amazing about the document is that it takes what some might call a petty quarrel over taxation. I'm not saying that it is a petty quarrel, but I am saying that many people would see it that way. And certainly it would be something that wouldn't have enormous resonance today or specific actions of the British government that are lost over the mists of time. And it elevates them to this stage of universality and human rights where it's remembered by people all over the world, whether they like the United States or they don't. This is quoted. Ho Chi Minh was a great fan, for instance, of the Declaration of Independence. And so it gains its immortality in that way. And I think that is the true genius of the document. Anyway, of course, Jefferson was a lawyer, as were most of the people in the government at that time, and much as sadly in these days as well. Not to offend any lawyers, but anyway. So, of course, what did Jefferson go on to do in the document but to basically indict King George III? And the bulk of the document is 27 grievances against the king, and they all, almost all of them, start with he has done this, he has done that, he has done the other thing. And I think there's several reasons for this. One is that it's easier to personify evil than it is to talk about a system that has some bad things in it. You know, it's easier to talk about Saddam Hussein than it is to talk about some of the complexities of Iraqi society. Just as an example. So it's easier to hate King George III than it is to hate all Britons or the British system. And, of course, King George III was easy to hate in many ways. He was a very unpredictable, capricious, mad man who kept changing his governments and who had very difficult time maintaining stability. So he was a good choice, who just happened to be the king at that time. I'm not going to go through all the 27 grievances. I'll just mention a couple of them. Of course, it's very propagandistic. It's meant to get people roused up. It doesn't show balance. It shows what our side is. So, for instance, one of them is for imposing taxes on us without our consent. But something that he doesn't mention is that as far as the Brits were concerned, they had a system of virtual representation where the parliament represented people whether or not they actually voted for them. And even though we like to say we don't have such a system, I could find some examples where that is definitely the case. So remember that while in Jefferson's mind and the mind of many of the colonists, they thought the only legitimate body that could tax them was their local legislatures. As far as the British were concerned, Parliament had every right to tax them. And of course, it's interesting, he doesn't mention Parliament at all in the whole document. You read through it, there's not a word about Parliament. There is a word about our British brethren and their legislature, but not called Parliament. Another thing he says is, in every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. So he lists all these 27 grievances, and he says, we patiently petitioned to have them changed. It's gotten us nowhere. And then he says, a prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. Those are fighting words. He's saying this prince is really more of a tyrant than a fit leader. And the whole idea of fitness really also has to do with abiding by the laws. He's not abiding by the laws. And then again, this all goes back to the whole nature of the universe. Our laws are universal laws, just like Newton's laws are universal laws. So it's a very ingenious way of taking what some might consider a minor quarrel and put it on a universal and ordered footing. Okay, I'm not going to go through the whole document except to say that later on he does talk about our British brethren and that we haven't had any better luck with them, and therefore we have no choice but to declare our independence and for the support of this declaration with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence. We mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. And that's what it was, because now they were traitors. Now they were traitors. And although there had been skirmishes, battles, and so on before the writing of this, we definitely were at war now, and there was really no turning back. Now, before I move on to what other people made of this declaration, I want to just talk for a little bit about Thomas Jefferson himself. It's interesting, since I've been teaching for so long, I can see real changes in my students in the way in which they regard Jefferson. When I went to school, as I like to tell them, you know, way back in the Stone Age, that when we studied Jefferson and we studied the Declaration of Independence, it was really like studying a god or a hero, and there was no question about his motives. There was no question about his character. And it was really the words of the document that carried the day. And nowadays, I get all kinds of questions from my students about, you know, did he really have an affair with one of his slaves? Was he really a slaveholder? Did he really want to end slavery? And so much of the discussion seems to be tied to that. And the Declaration is something that's just hardly even mentioned. So, of course, I do spend a lot of time on it, and I think it is important. But I think it's an indication of changing times. And I do want to say that Jefferson did have a longstanding relationship with one of his slaves, Sally Hemings. He was widowed. And one thing that is hardly ever mentioned about Sally Hemings is that she was the half-sister of Jefferson's wife. So he was in a long biblical tradition, in a way, of taking the sister of his deceased wife. But if we get into that, then that indicates that miscegenation and exploitation of slaves and slave women and so on were much more widespread than we often think. So anyway, as far as some of the blind spots that Jefferson had, and a lot of these are gotten from a work by Edmund Morgan, it's not to say that he was not a great man. It's just that, like I would say all great men, really, certainly the ones that I know about, they're not great in every single thing. They may be great in many things. And so Jefferson had some blind spots, which I might add, people, not all people of his day had in these areas. They may have had them in some other areas. First of all, he was very negative about cities. And I'm just going to give you a couple of quotes. in 1787, he wrote to Madison and said, "When we get piled upon one another in large cities, as in Europe, we shall become corrupt, as in Europe, and go to eating one another, as they do there." So anyway, that's just one of his quotes about cities. But I think one of the things that he disliked so much about cities is that in cities, people are interdependent. And I think he feared when people become too dependent on other people that they lose their ability to be truly democratic. So he was very negative about cities. He was, I would say, overly sanguine and commendatory, if there's such a word, of he praised them too much, and that is farmers. And he said, this is a very famous quote from his notes on Virginia, "Those who labor on earth are the chosen people of God." And what about the rest of us, you know? Of course, remember that when he wrote this, about 90% of the population was involved in farming. Immigrants. He was very wary of immigrants because he felt that, and of course most of the immigrants coming to the United States at that time would have been from Europe, that they were to bring with them the evils of monarchy and aristocracy, or the evils of the mob. And so he was very cautious about immigration, which was not really true of all of his contemporaries. Notably, for instance, Washington was more liberal on immigration. Hamilton was more liberal on immigration. On slavery, even though he spoke out against it, and he had a hand in the Northwest Ordinance, which prohibited slavery in the new Northwest Territory, meaning places like what would today be Illinois, Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin, so not Washington and Oregon. So he did do something to call attention to the evils of slavery and to try to abolish it where we had not already settled. But the fact is that in Virginia, he did very little to end it. This is a quote from Edmund Morgan. He had placed a higher value on collecting books and drinking good wine than on freeing his slaves. He was a man who lived in debt, and in order to get out of it, he would have had to have sold all his slaves, and you know, he wasn't willing to do that, and he wasn't willing to free his slaves either, because he, like many Americans at the time, didn't think it was possible for blacks and whites really to live together in which there was equality. In other words, they didn't have any training, they didn't have any education. And finally, by the way, when Virginia did pass a law making it easier to manumit or free your slaves, they had to leave the state after a certain period of time. So they didn't want them to stay. If they were going to stay, they had to be slaves. If they were going to not be slaves, then they had to leave. So he has a very spotty record on actions in his own place and his own day that would really have alleviated the condition of slavery. Women, that's another one that I think is interesting. He didn't believe they should be involved in politics. For instance, he said, comparing them favorably with their French counterparts who were involved in politics, he said, "American women are too wise to wrinkle their foreheads with politics." Okay, and I just chose that one. I could have chosen various others. Okay, education, he said, about reading. And here's a man who is so monumental in his intellectual powers and was so well-read. And this is what he says about reading as far as women are concerned. "Reading for women is, quote, useful for only filling up the chinks of more useful and healthy occupations," which I assume would be, you know, having children and knitting and various other things that he felt were more in keeping with their nature. Indians, I didn't read to you the 27th indictment of King George III, but just let me read it to you. "He," meaning King George III, "has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers the merciless Indian savages whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions." not very politically correct, I guess, but there it is. This is not to say that the Indians were not being egged on by the British. They were. This is not to say that the Indians were not a major military threat, because they were, something we tend to minimize. They were fierce and they were dangerous. But what I take issue with is that that they had no provocation, which of course is not mentioned here, or that we did the same thing to them, and then I guess we could degenerate into, no, he started it, no, he started it, no, he started it. But anyway, so that's one comment that he made. Another thing is that he considered the Indians to be noble savages, meaning that they were definitely savages, but they were educatable, that they could be changed to be more in line with what we would consider human beings. And that could be done if they assimilated into white society, or if they didn't, that they should move west into what was part of the Louisiana Purchase lands, which was much inferior land. But whether or not, whether they assimilated or whether they moved, they would have lost their land. So in these various ways, you know, Jefferson is, you might say, he had blind spots, which, as I said, is, you know, completely normal. I mean, the fact that he wrote those wonderful words in the Declaration is more than enough to make whatever faults he might have to more than redeem them. But it's interesting to note that he was a human being, you know, and he had the foibles and shortcomings that human beings have. Now, a couple of further comments, and then I'm going to move on to some of the people that use the Declaration in different ways. First of all, when Jefferson says all men are created equal, again, getting back to John's point, what constitutes a man? I think that to Jefferson, a man was a man who perhaps served in the House of Burgesses, the state legislature of Virginia, or the colonial legislature before that. And certainly Jefferson did. In other words, a man who had education, a man who was involved in public service. Probably he really meant an Englishman, because a lot of this, and this gets back to what I was saying about Locke, is really saying, we are Englishmen, and we're not being treated like Englishmen. We're not enjoying the rights of Englishmen. So suppose he'd written, all Englishmen are created equal. I don't think it would have much of a resonance today. But remember, we needed the French. The French, I know it may not be that popular to bring this up today, but, you know, the French really helped us win the Revolution. Probably without them, we wouldn't have won the Revolution. I don't think the rights of Englishmen carried much weight with the French. So so I think that really and truly what he meant were men and not women. What he meant were Englishmen who had enjoyed these rights, Englishmen who were educated, and Englishmen who were involved in public service. It's important, though, to recognize that Jefferson did believe in education, and even with his negative comments and thoughts about immigrants, slaves, and others, Indians, he believed that through education, that they could also join in this hallowed ranks of men. So there was potential, and it would take time. So it wasn't in any sense a kind of sense of racial superiority, but it was more experiential, I suppose you could say. Finally, on Jefferson, I just want to say that a good way of understanding what he considered to be the important achievements of his life are to look at his tombstone. And many of you know this, he had three things on his tombstone. One was that he was one of the authors of the Virginia Act for Religious Liberty. So religious liberty was extremely important to him. Many credit him with the whole idea of the wall of separation between church and state. And I think that part of his skepticism about religion is that it was used so much to shackle people, and it was used so much to divide people. So that was one of them, being one of the authors of the Act for Religious Liberty in Virginia. The founder, or one of the founders, of the University of Virginia, And again, that speaks to the way he valued education and the fact that it's a state school, so that it's available, really, to everyone, at least in the context of its day. And then finally, that he was the author of the Declaration of Independence. Notice what he leaves out. He doesn't say he was the president. He doesn't say that he was the governor. He doesn't say that he served in the House of Burgesses, all things that were very important, of course. But these are all things that free people, rather than where you're in a position of power over them. So I think that's all very much in character with Jefferson. Okay, I don't want to spend all my time on Jefferson, so I'm going to move on and talk about some people who made use of the Declaration for other ends, or for the way they saw it, their own liberties, their own freedoms. And the first group I want to talk about are the Lowell Mill women. One of our very first industries was the Lowell Mills in Massachusetts, the textile mills. And one of the things that Jefferson was very worried about was that we would become a commercial and industrial power, and he thought that would be corrupt. And so the people that started the Lowell Mills, and maybe he was right, I don't know. But anyway, the people, he turned out to, of course, be dead wrong on that, and Alexander Hamilton was right in terms of what the future of the nation was really going to be, rather than agriculture. But in any event, the founders of the Lowell Mills thought it would be a good idea to have women work there, because in that way they wouldn't be wouldn't become an entrenched proletariat as the industrial workers in Britain had become. In other words, they would be middle-class women, farming women basically, who would go and work at the mills for a couple of years and then go back home and marry and continue on in their lives, so that you would have a kind of rotating workforce, and by that means maintain our freedoms. So many of the workers in the mills were women, and at this time it was not only unusual for women to be working in such a setting, but also they organized a union. And it was not considered proper for middle-class women to speak in public at that time. And so these women were really very unusual in not only organizing a union and in holding a strike, but then speaking out about it. And I think it's really interesting to read a couple of things they say. They had two strikes. One was in 1834, and the other one was in 1836. So first I'll read you something that they said in 1834. Our present object is to have union and exertion, and remember, this is all women, and we remain in possession of our unquestionable rights. We circulate this paper wishing to obtain the names of all who imbibe the spirit of our patriotic ancestors, who preferred privation to bondage and parted with all that renders life desirable and even life itself to procure independence for their children. The oppressing hand of avarice would enslave us, and to gain their object, they gravely tell us of the pressure of the time. This we are already sensible of and deplore it. If any are in want of assistance, the ladies will be compassionate and assist them. But we prefer to have the disposing of our charities in our own hands. And as we are free, we would remain in possession of what kind Providence has bestowed upon us, and remain daughters of free men still. So they didn't want the mills to run their lives. They didn't want the mills to become their fathers. They had the patriotic fathers and grandfathers who said no to the British and stood up for their independence. These women had a lot of guts. Okay, then there's something else that I want to read to you. This was out of the 1836 strike. And this is a little song that they sang, but I'm not going to sing it. I'm just going to recite the words. Oh, isn't it a pity such a pretty girl as I should be sent to the factory to pine away and die? Oh, I cannot be a slave. Oh, I will not be a slave, for I'm so fond of liberty that I cannot be a slave. So they saw the revolution as an attempt by the British to enslave their fathers, grandfathers, and so forth, and they were not going to be enslaved by the mills. So I think that's a kind of interesting take on the Declaration and also on the meaning of the Declaration. Now, another thing I want to say about women, and I'll go through this pretty quickly because I think, you know, I'm taking up a little more time than I had planned. During the 1840s, there was a very active abolitionist movement, and many of you are probably aware of that because the Unitarians, many of the Unitarians were involved in it. And during the abolitionist conventions and so on, the women in the movement discovered that the men would not recognize them and that they couldn't hold office within the abolitionist societies and they couldn't fully participate in the abolitionist conventions. And so it led to many of these women starting what we know as the women's rights movement. And many of the women were involved in both of those movements, women's rights as well as abolition. And in 1848, in Seneca Falls, New York, you had the first convention for women's rights. And I want to read to you what was written there, and you can tell me if you don't see the connection to the Declaration of Independence. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one portion of the family of man to assume among the people of the earth a position different from that which they have hitherto occupied, but one to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes that impel them to such a course. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights are instituted, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. And then they go on to say that, you know, they wouldn't, just like Jefferson said in the Declaration, you know, we wouldn't just rebel the very first thing, but after a long train of abuses, we have no other choice. So then they have this long train of abuses that they list, and I'm not going to go through all of them, but I'll just mention a couple of them. He, meaning not George III anymore, but just the men of American society, has never permitted her to exercise her inalienable right to the elective franchise. He has compelled her to submit to laws in the formation of which she has no voice. He has withheld from her rights which are given to the most ignorant and degraded men, both natives and foreigners. He has made her, if married, in the eyes of the law, civilly dead. He has taken from her all right and property, even to the wages that she earns, and so on and so on. And there's a whole indictment of he. So I think the parallels there are really pretty clear. I'm going to be moving on now to, is okay? The time, okay. I'm going to be moving on now to Frederick Douglass, and I'm just going to read to you a speech that he gave on the 4th of July in 1852. I'm not reading you the whole speech, but I'm reading you part of it because I can in no way do it justice. So if you will just bear with me. He says, pardon me and allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I or those I represent to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in the Declaration of Independence extended to us? I say no. I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable difference between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is not shared by you, not by me. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak today? And then he goes on to give a scathing indictment of the United States. He said, that there's not a man on earth who does not know that slavery is wrong. And then I'm just going to read you the last two paragraphs. He says, what to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days in the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty an unholy license, your national greatness swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciations of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy. A thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of these United States at this very hour. Go where you may, search where you will, roam through all the monarchies and despotisms of the old world, travel through South America, search out every abuse, and when you have found the last, lay your facts by the side of the everyday practices of this nation, and you will say with me that for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without a rival. He was a man of great courage and sharp words. I think I've given you some idea here of different takes on Jefferson and the Declaration. If I am honored enough to be invited back another day, I will discuss Abraham Lincoln. So, okay, thank you.